Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hallbrook. First on this week's program, how Scottsdale cops botched a probe into a strip club drugging scheme. This story was written by Stephen Lemons and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on April 14th. This story is part of the Arizona Watchdog Project, a year-long reporting effort led by New Times and supported by the Trace Foundation, in partnership with Deep South Today. No wonder it went viral. In March 2024, Fox 10 broke a salacious story that seemed, perhaps, literally ripped from pop culture. A lawsuit filed by patrons of three Valley strip clubs, Dream Palace in Tempe, and Skin Cabaret and Bones Cabaret in Scottsdale, all situated along Scottsdale Road, claimed that dancers were drugging scores of customers and racking up six-figure charges on their credit cards. Speaking anonymously, with their faces obscured or darkened, two alleged victims told the news station that they believed they had fallen prey to the same scheme portrayed in the 2019 film Hustlers, which scored Jennifer Lopez as one of several New York City strippers who, well, drugged wealthy clients and ran up their credit cards to the max. Neither man could prove he'd been drugged, but each claimed that he was escorted to semi-private VIP rooms where they experienced extreme impairment. One man described symptoms not related to alcohol, something else that made me acquiesce and go along with what they seemed to be pushing. A month later, Fox 10 followed up with an interview with one of the club's former dancers, whose identity also was concealed. She'd seen men drugged, she said, their champagne spiked with roofies. At the time, there were 20 men telling similar stories in the lawsuit filed by Phoenix attorney Rod Galarza. The complaint, which is still winding its way through Maricopa County Superior Court, now boasts more than 40 plaintiffs, with the total amount of allegedly bogus charges exceeding $2.3 million. The Fox 10 story generated a host of second-wave news stories about allegedly shady doings at the clubs. And then, nothing. In 2024, the Scottsdale Police Department told Fox 10 that the accusations were part of an ongoing investigation into the clubs. And yet, no charges were ever filed in the case, and no charges appear likely to ever be filed. Scottsdale Police presented the case to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office and the Arizona Attorney General's Office for prosecution, only to have both decline the case because, in the words of spokespersons for both agencies, there was no reasonable likelihood of conviction. A spokesperson for the Attorney General's office added that the investigation's claims lacked sufficient evidence. Though Galarza's lawsuit persists, records show that if drugging was really going on at the clubs, Scottsdale police didn't try very hard to sniff it out. Scottsdale investigators didn't speak to any dancers working at the clubs, didn't search the club for drugs, and didn't send in undercover cops. Former club employees who did talk to police reported no direct knowledge of any drugging scheme. It raises the question, if all of this illicit Shanghai-style drugging and thievery was going on, why didn't Scottsdale police bust the joint and close them down? The question is addressed in a new lawsuit filed last month on behalf of Todd Borowski, who owns the Skin and Bones clubs. Borowski is the brother of Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski, though she was not yet in office when Scottsdale police first touted its investigation. Filed March 20th in federal court, the suit names the city of Scottsdale, the police department, and several individual cops as defendants, accusing them of perpetrating a vindictive sham investigation against the clubs. A spokesperson for the Scottsdale Police Department declined to comment. Borowski's suit claims and records obtained by Phoenix New Times show that Scottsdale police never found evidence of wrongdoing, much less that anyone was actually slipped a Mickey. And according to the Scottsdale cops' own reports, Borowski's clubs went to great lengths to document their clients' pricey forays into VIP rooms, requiring signed contracts, a fingerprint, and even a photo of the customer holding up the paperwork for each transaction. New Times has obtained several of these photos. The reams of documents and exhibits backing up the suit make clear that if there was any truth to the allegations of criminal drugging and credit card mugging, the Scottsdale Police Department's shoddy investigation screwed the proverbial pooch. Overlooking exculpatory evidence and repeatedly avoiding no-brainer investigative techniques. And though the cops couldn't prove that any dancers were misusing clients' credit cards, that didn't stop a Scottsdale investigator from figuratively reaching into the club's purses and messing with their bank accounts. Browski's complaint insists his clubs were targeted for a takedown and have lost business as a result of a cop conspiracy to run him out of Scottsdale. And his complaint offers plenty of corroboration for this assertion. Whether or not Scottsdale police were attempting to retaliate against Borowski for past conflicts remains unresolved. But the record shows that Scottsdale police definitely had a hard-on for his adult businesses and apparently sought to drive him to ruin. Skin and bones. It's not hard to see why the drugging scheme claims were believable. After all, the amounts that strip club clientele spent at the three establishments are staggering. One man supposedly charged a total of $179,200. Another charged $177,100. A third racked up $65,000 in charges, and so on. Many of those listed in the complaint filed by Galarza used American Express, which processed the charges. Each plaintiff seems to have unwittingly been drugged and kidnapped by being separated from their friends and led into VIP rooms. Once they were incapacitated, their wallets and ID were allegedly taken from them, and their signatures and thumbprints either faked or forced onto contracts. Then, they supposedly were propped up for photos to document their purchases, despite being heavily drugged. The latest version of Galarza's complaints lists American Express, Borowski's two clubs, and his affiliated LLCs as defendants. It alleges that the clubs engaged in a pattern of illegal behavior, and that Amex effectively looked the other way as the clubs rang up the charges on its cards to insane amounts. American Express did not respond to a request for a comment, but Galarza told New Times that he is currently in 31 arbitration proceedings against American Express, which he can't discuss in detail because the process is confidential. The only thing I can tell you is that my clients are happy, he said. Galarza pointed to the similarity in the tales being told by his clients and the fact that they didn't know each other as evidence that they were victims of a racketeering conspiracy. Many of the men conceded to Scottsdale investigators that they had been drinking prior to arriving at one of the clubs. Some claim their fingerprints and signatures were forged, though the Attorney General's office told New Times that it found no evidence of forgeries. Others contend that they were forced to sign and give fingerprints. Interestingly, according to Galarza's complaint, a few of the plaintiffs admit to charging exorbitant amounts, just not nearly as exorbitantly as they were ultimately billed. A Bones patron states that he was rendered incapacitated by something given to him by club representatives and charged a total of $177,100, but admitted to authorizing an astonishing $17,884 of the total. The guy who was charged $179,200 spent more than 6 hours at the same establishment, although he acknowledged that drinks and a private dance cost him $8,400, which he authorized. Other than the eye-popping credit card receipts, though, there's a notable lack of hard evidence that anything criminal was amiss. None of the men can prove that they were drugged or, more importantly, that they were drugged at the strip clubs. All of which sounds like morning after shame to Dennis Willinchick, the attorney representing Borowski in both lawsuits. He believes patrons of the club got caught up in the moment and, as indie rocker Beck once sang, go crazy with the cheese whiz. Nobody's putting a gun to their head, Willinchick said, of the supposedly drugged patrons. They get back home, they sober up, and they realize, what the fuck did I just do? Despite the sometimes six-figure bills, Willinchick finds the I was drugged excuse a little too convenient. I can find no evidence anybody was drugged, okay? Said Willinchick, who also has represented Borowski's sister, the Scottsdale mayor, in other matters. And if they were, it certainly wasn't with management's knowledge. Coming up empty. Indeed, the best backup for Willinchick's advocacy is the record of a piss-poor investigation done by the Scottsdale cops into the claims of mass drugging being done in their backyard. Borowski's lawsuit claims the Scottsdale investigation was retaliation for a series of events in which ex-Scottsdale police officers at the Arizona Department of Liquor Licenses and Control investigated Skin Cabaret during the COVID-19 pandemic over governmental social distancing directives. The club was suspended in 2020 for allegedly violating COVID protocols. Shortly after, the investigator in the case was accused of inappropriately touching a dancer at Skin Cabaret. The same investigator had been in trouble previously for allegedly inserting his finger into the vagina of a stripper at the Highlighter Gentlemen's Club in Phoenix. The fallout from the scandal triggered internal investigations and the resignation of two senior liquor control officials. According to Borowski's complaint and supporting documents, a Scottsdale police commander was also reprimanded for his back-channel discussions with liquor authority officials about the dancer's complaint. As a result, the Borowski lawsuit maintains the Scottsdale Police Department muckamucks harbored retaliatory animus toward Borowski and his clubs. A lot of this is my conjecture, said Willinchick, but as I see it, Scottsdale was going after people like Todd Borowski, who they blamed for basically being part of a group that got rid of their buddies at the liquor department. That may be true, but police agencies in general have never needed an excuse to harass adult businesses, which are catnip for cops. And Borowski was already on the Scottsdale Police Department's radar. In 2006, he and other strip club owners helped overturn Scottsdale's onerous anti-lap dance regulations. Over the years, Scottsdale police have raided and charged Borowski's clubs several times. The probe into the alleged druggings began in 2021, when Dennis Metz, a detective with Scottsdale Police's Financial Crimes Unit, was assigned to look into complaints of extreme overbilling and possible druggings at Borowski's cabarets. Initially, most of the complaints had been quickly closed by police. In a revealing transcript of a July 2025 arbitration proceeding, which New Times obtained from Willinchick, Metz was questioned by Galarza and attorneys for the credit card companies involved. Metz said that prior to his investigation, police treated the complaints as a civil issue and labeled them as such. But Metz began reopening complaints against the clubs from years prior, relabeling them as suspected violations of state laws against fraudulent schemes and artifices. He informed his fellow cops that any calls involving the three clubs should be written up and the reports sent to him. From 2019 to 2024, he said, he identified 96 suspect complaints, 29 of which involved American Express. Many of the complainants were not interested in filing charges. According to Borowski's lawsuit, Few had claimed to have been drugged when they first disputed their charges, only doing so after Metz reopened their complaints. New Times has not been able to verify this assertion. Still, Metz testified in his arbitration deposition that no charges were ever brought, and that he could not establish a criminal conspiracy, and had no evidence of anyone being drugged or anything else illegal. When questioned by the attorneys and the arbitration judge, Metz said he had never requested a toxicology report during his years-long investigation. It didn't matter anyway, he said, because even if the toxicology report turned up positive, there would be no way to know if a customer had been doped at one of the clubs. The investigation involved other officers, as many as 8, according to Borowski's complaint. But Scottsdale police never assigned any undercover operatives to snoop around the clubs. Why not? Metz said that the idea was discussed by his unit and by the Arizona Attorney General's office, which joined the probe at one point. But they decided against it because there were a lot of risks. If there is any truth to clients or customers being drugged, if I send an undercover in there, that undercover is potentially going to get drugged, he said. That seems a particularly lame excuse, given that undercover cops get into lots of sketchy situations involving drugs, gun buys, organized crime, and more. Risky activities that, if undertaken by police, have the benefit of providing a criminal allegation. Metz also claimed that strippers could spot an undercover cop a mile away, which suggests that exotic dancers are somehow more wary of potential narcs and better at sniffing them out than drug dealers. Metz claimed there was never a task force formed for the investigation, and that, surprisingly, he never listened to any of the initial recordings of calls from suspected victims or read their associated transcripts. Nor did he recall any of the complainants saying that their signature had been forged. Metz and the Attorney General's office did subpoena records from the clubs and various financial institutions, but they turned up bupkis. One would think more than 40 people saying that they were drugged and ripped off might be enough to request a search warrant to look for whatever was being used to allegedly zonk out clubgoers. But there's nothing in the transcript or in any of the police reports obtained by New Times that proves this happened. Do the hustle. Metz testified that his investigation foundered because no one wanted to talk to me. I couldn't get dancers or managers to talk to me. In fact, Metz did talk to at least 2 former employees, as well as the club's bookkeeper and a manager. None of them offered any indication that druggings were afoot. Quite the contrary. As is recounted both in Metz's testimony and in an August 2025 summary of his investigation, Metz and another detective met with the bookkeeper for skin and bones and with other employees. The bookkeeper believed all the charges were legit, and the employees explained the process they have for documenting large credit card charges, a signed contract, a fingerprint, and a photo for each charge in a VIP room, all done in case the cardholder challenges the bill. The prices for a VIP room are $400 to $600 for 15 minutes, $800 to $1,200 for 30 minutes, and $1,500 to $2,500 for an hour, Metz's report states. Tips are extra. When the time ends for the customer, they can choose to add further time. If they do, they need to take another photograph, sign a contract, and thumbprint it. Drinks are included in the price of a VIP room. A manager gave Metz and the other officer a tour of Bones Cabaret, where they saw the VIP rooms. The cops were told that the dancers needed a permit from the city of Scottsdale before the women were allowed to dance. The detectives later received copies of the contracts signed by customers. In his police report, Metz stated that he asked the bookkeeper about one hostess who was tasked with taking photos and acquiring documentation. He was told the woman was an ex-employee who left on bad terms. In other words, a potential witness. Metz and an agent with the Attorney General's office, Heidi Chance, eventually interviewed this former employee via Zoom. But despite being involved in a labor dispute with the clubs, the employee threw water on the idea that anyone would be drugged and manipulated. She admitted that it might be possible for a dancer to drug a customer, but she had never seen such activity, and if she had, she would have informed a manager, who would have been pissed. She also noted that after the movie Hustlers came out, more customers claimed they were drugged. But she could not understand why the customers would say they were drugged, because customers would need to physically speak with their banks to get their charges approved. She had never heard of dancers using customers' phones to approve charges with the credit card companies, or of dancers holding the phones up to the customers' faces to gain access to the phones, as alleged in Galarza's complaint. She never saw anyone put roofies or other drugs into the champagne that came with the VIP rooms, and explained that the bottles were unopened until brought into the rooms. She never saw a customer being posed by hostesses for photographs or saw fingerprints and signatures being faked. In his arbitration testimony, Metz described interviewing another former Skin and Bones dancer who had been arrested on an unrelated warrant. The dancer told him she had never seen customers being drugged, nor had she participated in doing so. But she did report that other dancers used to giggle in the locker room about drugging the customers with Visine, which, according to various sources, contains an ingredient that could be used to facilitate sexual assault. However, in the parlance of attorneys, that's referred to as hearsay. In his investigative report, Metz observed that all of the reporting parties report being in some state of intoxication before arriving at the cabarets, or in the cabarets themselves. Indeed, Metz had recontacted the reporting parties to interview them about an alleged conspiracy to drug patrons at the clubs. Browski's complaint suggests that it was hearing about the alleged scheme from Metz weeks, months, or years after the fact that gave complainants the bright idea to say they were drugged. When asked about the massive charges incurred by some customers, Metz testified in his deposition that, "I still can't prove whether or not they're legitimate." Eyes wide shut. Despite the lack of proof, or indeed evidence, to the contrary, Metz and Scottsdale police still took steps to screw with their club's businesses. Some contradictory evidence exists in the form of photos of supposedly drugged patrons with their bills. Several such photos were given to New Times by Willinchick, though New Times has not seen all of the photos in the case, nor is New Times identifying the men depicted in them. Several snapshots show Bones Cabaret patrons holding up signed contracts with shit-eating grins on their faces. One alleged victim is shown sitting up in a chair by himself, eyes wide open, and a huge smile on his face as he holds his contracts with the club aloft. He's wearing a t-shirt with a heart that reads, "I'm scum." When asked, Galarza said he was unfamiliar with the "I'm scum" photo, but he said context was important. More than one photograph may have been taken of the individual during his sojourn in the VIP room. The question is, which was first? But Galarza agreed that someone can black out and forget events from drinking too much alcohol, a common enough occurrence to be the basis for the Hangover movie series. The photos present a persuasive case that at least some of the massive charges were made with the full knowledge of the customers, which is the entire reason the photos were taken. They're part of why many of the aggrieved patrons have so far been unsuccessful in overturning the charges with their credit card companies. So, unable to make the case against Borowski's clubs in a criminal filing, Scottsdale leaned on one credit card company to drive Borowski underground. Metz reached out to a contact who was a fraud investigator at American Express, informing her that the clubs were under criminal investigation and laying out the suspected conspiracy afoot. Metz testified in the arbitration hearing that he never advised the Amex investigator on what to do. Yet, in one April 2022 email to his superiors, included as an exhibit to the Borowski lawsuit, Metz wrote a to-do list that included, contact American Express and ask about the possibility if they can revoke their products from use in Skin and Bones. According to Willinchick, Amex complied, canceling out a huge source of revenue for Borowski's cabarets. Metz also exchanged several emails with Galarza between 2022 and 2024, with Galarza sending at least one of his clients to file a police report on the suspect credit card charges. Galarza told New Times that this was for a credit card company, which needed a report for their investigation of the charges. In one email to Metz, Galarza asked if he had a record of ever contacting the credit card companies involved. In another, Metz requested documents from Galarza regarding one of the counselor's clients and the client's dispute with Amex. Galarza sent them to Metz later that day, saying, here's what I have. Metz also sent Galarza's info to investigators with the Attorney General's office, telling them that he had received a call from Galarza, who has multiple subjects that may be able to assist in the case. Galarza initially confirmed to New Times that he'd had communications with Metz, but when pressed on details in the emails, he said he had no comment. When Fox 10 broadcast its stories on the allegations, the mood at the Scottsdale Police Department was practically celebratory. Emails show Metz and other officers passed around links to the pieces, with Metz forwarding a link to the Attorney General's office. They never turned the investigation into actual convictions or even an indictment, but they'd managed to damage a private business, albeit a socially disfavored one. They were out to get Todd, Willinchick said, adding that the clubs have lost a lot of revenue as a result of the saga. Metz set out with a couple of others on a path to destroy them, and they did. What becomes of Borowski's lawsuit remains to be seen. The competing lawsuit from the cabaret clients is still ongoing, even if the police investigation stalled out, due to a lack of evidence, incompetence, or some other reason. Everybody's looking to pick everyone else's pocket, Willinchick said, of the suit against the clubs. And now, we're going to try to pick Scottsdale's pocket. If nothing else, he added, we'll get the story out in the end. Will the Swalwell scandal nuke Ruben Gallego's presidential chances? This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on April 16th. Democratic Senator Ruben Gallego wants to be president one day. But since the bombshell sexual assault allegations dropped about now former California Representative Eric Swalwell, a man Gallego has described as his best friend, those hopes appear to have taken a major hit. On Friday, the San Francisco Chronicle and CNN reported that Swalwell, a Democrat who was running for California governor, allegedly engaged in inappropriate sexual behavior with several different women, including congressional staffers. Those sexual encounters included two instances in which a woman says Swalwell raped her when she was too intoxicated to give consent, as well as the married Swalwell sending two women unsolicited photos of his penis. Since that initial reporting, more allegations of sexual misconduct and rape by Swalwell have surfaced. He suspended his gubernatorial campaign on Sunday, days after Gallego yanked his endorsement, and resigned from Congress mere minutes after Gallego called on him to quit. Swalwell's attorney, Sarah Azari, has said that Swalwell denies each and every allegation of sexual misconduct and assault made against him, calling them false, fabricated, and deeply offensive. The blowback has hit Gallego, who chaired Swalwell's short-lived 2020 presidential campaign. Gallego has faced intense scrutiny over his relationship with Swalwell, which has generated questions about what he knew, when, and why he never did anything about it. Initially defending Swalwell last week, Gallego held a long, emotional press conference on Tuesday, in which he said Swalwell lied to and betrayed him. He acknowledged having heard rumors that Swalwell was flirty with women, but said he allowed his longtime friendship with Swalwell and his family to cloud his judgment, which was wrong. Gallego said he never saw the married father of three engage in any of the predatory behavior, harassment, sexual assault, though Gallego did say that he confronted Swalwell when the sexual misconduct rumors began circulating weeks ago. "He lied to me," Gallego told reporters. If Gallego still harbors presidential aspirations, he's generated buzz on that score, though perhaps not as much as fellow Arizonan Senator Mark Kelly, the Swalwell connection may tank them. "He's fucked for 2028, said one Republican political consultant who spoke to Phoenix New Times on the condition of anonymity. His chances of 2028 ended last Friday. He has to stop thinking about 2028 and just start thinking about 2030. Gallego will be up for re-election in 2030. His campaign did not respond to questions about whether he thinks the Swalwell scandal will affect his viability as a presidential candidate. "It's not even over. He still faces a lot of questions," said the GOP political consultant. "We don't know the extent of this yet, because there are still so many unresolved issues." While many politicos are still questioning how much Gallego really knew, one Arizona-based Democratic consultant, who was also granted anonymity to speak freely, doubts that there's any dirty laundry left to be aired about Gallego. "I think what happened with Swalwell was that it was his first time really being at this important precipice," the consultant said. "And I think people were like, man, I need to tell my story before this guy becomes governor." By contrast, he said, Gallego has already been under the spotlight. During his Senate campaign against Kerry Lake in 2024, Gallego's past was raked over. The records from his divorce from Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego were unsealed and mostly boring, and Lake's campaign tried unsuccessfully to tar him with the sins of his father, who has a long criminal drug history and left Gallego's family when he was young. Gallego also has been open about his struggles with PTSD after serving in the Iraq War, and the impact that had on his marriage and personal relationships. If someone had something truly damaging to reveal about Gallego, the Democratic consultant said, he figures it would have surfaced then. Rubin already had that moment where he's about to become senator, and people didn't come out, the consultant said. That doesn't mean damaging info can't come out about Gallego, or that there isn't a secret yet to be revealed. Though, inaccurate claims about him using campaign funds for his wedding probably ain't it. But it also may be moot as far as presidential campaigning is concerned. Another Republican-leaning consultant, Chuck Coughlin, of the Phoenix firm High Ground, questions the entire premise of Rubin Gallego, presidential frontrunner. Coughlin noted that while Gallego won a statewide election in a year when Donald Trump comfortably carried the state, he also did so by beating a notoriously weak candidate in Lake. That win, and the presidential chatter he's received to this point, had more to do with the quality of his opposition than anything else, Coughlin said. Coughlin, who is no MAGA cheerleader, thinks Gallego has a bright future and is well-intentioned, but is also not ready for the presidency and is a long way from trying to represent the country. As for whether the Swalwell connection will permanently damage Gallego, Coughlin says that unless more information comes out about Gallego, he tends to believe the senator's claims of being blindsided. "Does anybody really know anybody else?" Coughlin said. "In this day and age, people put up fronts. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt on that." Here's a story written by Zach Buchanan and posted on April 17th. cop who hounded student protesters had glowing performance reviews. What would lead an off-duty Phoenix cop to show up at a student anti-ICE protest with a gun and attempt to bait kids into assaulting him? In the case of Dustin Wallen, the Phoenix police sergeant who was accused of doing just that earlier this year, the answer won't be found in his personnel file. In fact, according to the Phoenix Police Department, files provided in response to a public records request, Mullen's supervisors did little but gush over his performance each time he came up for a review. The stark contrast, model employee on paper, masked provocateur when off the clock, raises obvious questions about the efficacy of the department's evaluation process. Mullen is currently on administrative leave while the department investigates his actions. An attorney for Mullen, Steve Serbalik, has challenged the reasons for placing him on leave. The incident that landed Mullen on leave occurred during a January 30th protest against Immigration and Customs Enforcement outside Hamilton High School in Chandler. According to reports, a student alerted a Chandler police officer to a suspicious man in a mask who was nearby. That man turned out to be Mullen. The Chandler officer confronted Mullen, who was arguing with students and had a holstered handgun and two extra magazines. Mullen allegedly told the Chandler officer, "My plan is to legitimately just let them all assault me and you guys arrest them all, and I'll keep it on film. I also have other people filming from a distance." No such assault occurred, though Chandler police later reported arresting a teen girl who allegedly threw a water bottle at Mullen. In reality, a teen girl reportedly splashed water from a cup onto Mullen, who wanted to press charges. Per Fox 10, county prosecutors declined to charge the girl. Interestingly, just 4 days before potentially jeopardizing his career by harassing some kids, Mullen's supervisors gave him an overwhelmingly positive performance review. In an entry dated January 26th, Phoenix Police Lieutenant Robert Knapp of the South Mountain Precinct lavished praise on Mullen for his great attitude, his ability to lead, and his ability to be fair and balanced in his investigative documentation. Precinct Commander Rick Lavis added that Mullen was an experienced, professional, and dedicated leader, and called his work product exemplary. Mullen was given an overall rating of exceptional by Knapp, and was listed as having met every performance expectation set for him. For Mullen, who was promoted to sergeant in 2021 after 13 years as an officer, glowing evaluations are an overriding theme of his personnel file. He was listed as having met expectations and never listed as having not met them in every single performance review in his file, which also includes several commendations. There was only one disciplinary action listed in his file, a written reprimand for failing to impound drugs and drug paraphernalia after an arrest in 2016. The reprimand notes that Mullen found the items in his police vehicle's glove box 3 months later and impounded them then, writing a report to explain his mistake. That lapse is not referenced in any of his performance evaluations. Year after year, and sometimes multiple times a year, a series of different supervisors gave Mullen kudos for his police work, attitude, and professionalism. "Dustin, your work ethic and accomplishments reflect your character, personality, and demeanor," one supervisor wrote in 2012. "You have been and continue to be a valuable asset to our squad and the Phoenix Police Department." In 2016, another supervisor wrote that, "It is apparent that you enjoy your work and providing community outreach to the citizens whom you serve." In a 2022 evaluation, a supervisor rated Mullen's performance as superior. Serbalik did not respond to an inquiry from Phoenix New Times about Mullen. New Times also sent questions to the Phoenix Police Department about its employee evaluation system, specifically about its efficacy, if it missed signs of someone about to do something as boneheaded as Mullen allegedly did. The department has not responded. Frank Milstead, the former director of the Arizona Department of Public Safety and a former Phoenix police commander, noted that the effectiveness of a performance review system depends on how people use it. The Phoenix Police Department uses Blue Team from the software company Versaterm, which advertises its ability to identify and address out-of-standard behavior early. But the system can't flag behavior it doesn't know about. If somebody is going to do something crazy, you hope that they've outed through the early warning system, Milstead told New Times. Obviously, the system is only as good as the information that it takes in. Blue Team asks supervisors to indicate whether an employee met or did not meet certain goals, but provides no other method for quantifying performance. Milstead said that that's a change from decades ago, when department employees were rated on a 1-6 scale, with 1 being exemplary. By flattening the evaluation system, Milstead thinks, it's easier to miss potentially troubling trends. Though not familiar with Mullen, Milstead said it would strike him as odd for any employee's personnel file to contain no negative or even middling reviews. You might get one or two that make you out to walk on water, but somewhere along the line, I would think the true story would catch up to him, Milstead said. Supervisors change, leadership changes, oversight changes. To be continuously exceed standards would be unusual to me. On the other hand, Mullen was rarely evaluated by the same supervisor twice in a row, which Milstead said would make the notion that he slipped under the radar less likely, in my opinion. Perhaps it just goes to show how someone can crush it at work and act like a complete fool when off the clock. Ideally, though, those types wouldn't be police officers. Next, a story by Morgan Fisher, posted on April 15th. Mysterious Green Party governor candidate has loads of GOP connections. Ahead of the July primary election, the Arizona governor's race is packed. 8 candidates have made the ballot so far, though some may drop off due to petition signature challenges. One, however, is not like the others, or at least she's not like the party she supposedly represents. Green Party candidate Risa Lombardo appears to have no real affiliation with the party. She is a registered Green Party member. She has to be in order to run, though it's not clear how recently she joined the party. Phoenix New Times has requested, but not yet received, her registration information from the Maricopa County Recorder's Office. Instead, Lombardo may be a sham or stealth MAGA candidate who is in fact a member of a local independent conservative group. The Arizona Green Party first sounded the alarm about Lombardo and 2 other suspect Green Party candidates in December. We do not know these candidates, and they have never been involved in the AZGP, the party wrote, adding that petition circulators were calling the candidates independents. The other 2 suspicious candidates were fellow gubernatorial candidate Lisa Castillo, who did not make the ballot, and Secretary of State candidate Duane Collier. Arizona Green Party Secretary John Ralston declined to issue an official statement on behalf of the party regarding Lombardo and the other stealth candidates until lawsuits challenging their petition signatures are decided. Those suits were decided on April 16th, with a judge ruling that Lombardo had enough ballot signatures to appear on the Green Party primary ballot. The Arizona Green Party has a long-standing problem with candidates who don't represent the party's values, hijacking the Green Party's ballot line for their own purposes, Swing said. It's done with the intent to try to take away votes from Democrats of those offices and help elect Republicans by splitting the vote. This most recently occurred in Arizona's 2024 Senate race. 2 candidates, Mike Norton and Arturo Hernandez, filed enough signatures to appear on the Green Party primary ballot. But Green Party members hadn't heard of either of them and accused outside interests of meddling in the party's primary elections for political gain. There are just more than 5,000 registered Green Party members in the state, according to the Arizona Secretary of State. but Green Party candidates can draw far more votes than that, albeit not enough to actually win many elections. 2 years ago, Eduardo Quintana, the party's ultimate candidate for the Senate, topped 75,000 votes. Senator Ruben Gallego won that race by just more than 80,000 votes, and plenty of other recent contests have been much closer. What they're doing may be legal, but I would argue that it's unethical, Swing said. These candidates don't represent what the Green Party represents. They're trying to take over a ballot line of a political party that they don't represent. Republican ties. In an email to New Times, Lombardo wrote that she's very sincere about this effort, despite not having put up a website or solicited donations. She added that she's been both a registered Democrat and Republican in her life, and that my ex-husband is a Republican. My kids are Democrats. She said she supports fair and transparent elections and reforms on critical issues like education, homelessness, and the prison system. I ultimately registered with the Green Party because its platform best reflects my principles, she wrote. I'm running for governor to be a voice for everyone being ignored by the major parties and to champion issues that matter to every Arizonan. I think a lot of voters would agree that, on the whole, neither party seems interested or capable of fixing the problems we face. However, the documentation available of Lombardo's views suggests that she doesn't quite fit the Green Party mold of an anti-war activist and environmentalist. Business filings show Lombardo is the statutory agent for the National Freedom Coalition, an independent conservative group that describes itself as a community education group dedicated to principles of continued free government. Per a 2024 Arizona Sun-Times article, the group was established after the 2022 election by conservative grassroots leader Michael Lombardo. His relation to Risa is unclear, and former state lawmaker Josh Barnett as a more right-wing, independent version of the Republican Legislative District 2 Committee after the 2022 election. The LD2 Republican Committee's finance reports also show two cash payments to Lombardo in 2025, totaling $404.33, supposedly for postage. The committee has not responded to an inquiry from the New Times about these payments. Lombardo's National Freedom Coalition group meets at an IHOP in North Phoenix. A video on the group's Rumble account, named Affidavit Mamas 2.0, features a November meeting that included an appearance from GOP gubernatorial candidate Andy Biggs, a potential election opponent for Lombardo, should she survive the Green Party primary. According to an Instagram post, Jay Feely, the Trump-endorsed candidate for Arizona's 1st Congressional District, also spoke to the group in early April. It's not clear if Lombardo was at those meetings. Lombardo herself doesn't appear to have made any political donations to federal campaigns, according to Federal Election Commission data. But fellow National Freedom Coalition leader Deborah Boehm has donated more than $600 to Republican political campaigns since 2020, including Trump's Make America Great Again committee and Barnett's congressional run. The interests of Risa Lombardo seem to be aligned with what would be diametrically opposed to the values of the Green Party, Swing said. I do not see her as someone who represents the Green Party or its values, based on what little I know of her, and her association with various conservative MAGA Republican interests. Lombardo's GOP ties also extend to the group that helped her make the ballot. According to the lawsuits that challenged the validity of Lombardo's signatures, conservative circulator group Uncle Sam Petitions collected signatures on her behalf. Uncle Sam Petitions owner Bruce Gorsch has donated nearly $4,500 to Republican campaigns since 2019, including various Trump campaigns, according to FEC filings. Additionally, all of Uncle Sam's petition circulators registered with the state for the 2026 election cycle, including Duane Collier, the supposed Green Party candidate for Secretary of State, and they are listed as paid circulators. Lombardo's campaign finance reports show no expenses and no donations, raising the question of who paid circulators to collect her signatures. The program continues now with this from writer Zach Buchanan. It was posted on April 13th. The famous sports figures bankrolling Jay Feely's run for Congress. Getting ahead in politics is sometimes about who you know, and unsurprisingly, former Arizona Cardinals kicker Jay Feely knows a lot of famous sports figures. As the 49-year-old Republican has revved the engines on a congressional campaign, first in Arizona's 5th congressional district, and after some political calculus led to a switch in the 1st, he called upon those contacts for quite a lot of financial support. From the time he announced his campaign last April through the end of 2025, the Trump-endorsed Feely raised more than $1 million in campaign funds. Nearly a third of that, $330,000, was loaned to his campaign by Feely himself. Additionally, according to Federal Election Commission data examined by Phoenix New Times, more than $204,000 in donations came from figures across the sports world. That includes NFL coaches, executives, and former players, as well as several luminaries in the sports broadcasting world. Feely is also a football broadcaster for CBS. That Feely would hit up his sports connections to get his campaign off the ground would hardly be called controversial, but his campaign finance records do offer an interesting look at the extent of his powerful sports connections. As one might expect, many current and former Cardinals figures are among Feely's donors. Former Cards tight end Todd Heap gave $250. Ex-head coach Bruce Arians gave Feely $500. And former assistant Harold Goodwin and his wife donated at least $1,000. Ken Wisenhunt, another former Cards head coach, donated $3,500. More notable was the level of support from the Bidwell family, which owns the team. Cardinals owner Michael Bidwell gave $7,000, the legal maximum, with half earmarked for the general election, should Feely advance past the primary, while three other members of the Bidwell family combined to give another $13,000. Feely also landed support from NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, $7,000, league attorney Jeffrey Pash, $1,000, and league executive Courtney Seelman, $3,500. Other NFL owners have chipped in, including Atlanta Falcons owner Arthur Blank, $3,500, New England Patriots owner Bob Kraft, $7,000, Miami Dolphins owner Stephen Ross, $5,000, and Denver Broncos owner S. Robson Walton, $7,000. Cleveland Browns owner Jimmy Haslam and several of his family members chipped in a combined $28,000. Feely played for the Falcons and Dolphins during his career, but never the Patriots, Broncos, or Browns. There's also a who's who of NFL coaches and retired players. Among the coaches are former New York Giants head coach Tom Coughlin, $5,000, Minnesota Vikings head coach Kevin O'Connell, $500, former Dallas Cowboys head coach Wade Phillips, $2,000, and current Giants head coach John Harbaugh, $5,000, along with his wife. It does not appear that Feely has won the financial support of Harbaugh's brother, San Diego Chargers head coach Jim Harbaugh. Ex-players supporting Feely included former New York Jets receiver Jericho Cotchery, $49, former Broncos quarterback John Elway, $2,000, former Las Vegas Raiders quarterback Rich Gannon, $500, former Kansas City Chiefs quarterback Trent Green, $1,000, along with his wife, former Dolphins center Richie Incognito, $1,000, former Indianapolis Colts center Jeff Saturday, $600, along with his wife, and former Chicago Bears linebacker Brian Urlacher, $7,000. Feely also landed $7,000 from one Joan Romo, who, judging by her address, appears to be the mother of former Cowboys quarterback and current CBS broadcaster Tony Romo. Feeley has also pulled support from others in the Arizona sports world. Ex-Arizona Diamondbacks shortstop Nick Ahmed gave him $1,000, while Diamondbacks owner Ken Kendrick and his wife Randy, longtime supporters of conservative candidates, donated a combined $14,000. Jerry Moyes, the former owner of the Arizona Coyotes, gave Feeley $2,000, and former Diamondbacks and Phoenix Suns owner Jerry Colangelo gave $1,000. Ex-Sun star Charles Barkley gave $7,000, and former Coyotes player Jeremy Roenick and his wife gave $750. There's also a grab bag of donations from people connected to Feeley's broadcasting career, including $500 from basketball analyst Greg Anthony and $3,500 from broadcasting legend Jim Nantz. Then there are more seemingly random sports figures: golfer Fred Couples, $1,000, former Los Angeles Angels outfielder Tim Salmon, $7,000, and the wife of baseball analyst John Smoltz, $3,500. New Times sent an inquiry to Feeley's campaign spokesperson asking if Feeley wanted to expound on the relationships he's built with some of his famous sports backers. No response was provided. Feeley has another campaign finance report due later this week, and his campaign has already teased another big fundraising haul. More than $740,000 raised in the first 3 months of 2026. So far, sports figures, including himself, have accounted for more than half of his campaign cash, so it will be interesting to see to what extent regular voters are accounting for that new sum. So far, though, Feeley's war chest just goes to show how far kicking a ball accurately for 15 years will get you. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for other interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.